From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last night, NATO mounted its heaviest airstrikes yet on Belgrade. On today's Fresh Air, we call Belgrade and talk with Serb writer and political analyst Alexa Gilas. He'll describe life during the airstrikes and tell us why he strongly opposes the NATO bombing. Then we'll call a refugee camp in Macedonia and talk with Randy Ackley of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Many of the refugees got separated from their families along the way and are desperately trying to find them. We'll talk with Martin Merkelbach, who's trying to help the most vulnerable people, including children and the elderly, reunite with their families. Merkelbach runs the ICRC's tracing services. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Random House, publisher of Working on God by Winifred Gallagher.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, NATO mounted its heaviest air raids yet on Belgrade. This morning, we called Belgrade to talk with Aleksa Djilas, a Serb writer who lives in the heart of the city. He's been critical of Milosevic in the past, but he's strongly opposed to the NATO bombing. He's an active voice in Serb political debate, appearing regularly on TV as a political analyst and writing articles for several publications. He's had several op-ed pieces published in the New York Times. Djilas is the author of the book The Contested Country, Yugoslav Unity and Communist Revolution, and he's a former research associate at Harvard's Russian Research Center. I asked him which night of bombing was the worst for him.
Well, interestingly, you know, I'm a kind of person who is nervous before the event, you know. Like, when I went to school and to the university, I would be nervous. I was anxious before the exam. But when the exam started, I was not, you know. So for me, the most anxious were the first few days of bombing. For example, the night after Javier Solana, General Secretary of NATO, authorized airstrikes against Yugoslavia, then I was nervous. But then once the first bombs started to fall, and then when I saw some houses burning and broken glass and so on, so all this became somehow real for me. Then since then I'm coping mostly, right? At the beginning I've had several nights where I hardly slept at all. But now, I mean, I cannot say I sleep well, but I do sleep, you know. So I'm doing well. My wife suffered very badly during the first week because we have two small children. You know, the daughter is 2 years old and the son is 4 years old. My wife, by the way, is in her mid-30s. She's a dentist. And she, for the first 7 days, she hardly ate and slept and lost something like 12 pounds. And 6 pounds were a welcome loss, but the rest should have stayed where it was. And we used to joke, you know, is this finally the West has discovered the perfect quickie diet, you know, but that sort of macabre humor. But then, of course, for example, people with children are very nervous. Then older people are quite nervous. And another interesting phenomenon in Belgrade, right? No one has noticed this, you know. But Belgrade, in a sense, has become a city of refugees, you know, because Belgrade has something like 2 million inhabitants. And very many people have left Belgrade. You know, they went either to Hungary or they went to the villages surrounding Belgrade, where they believe, you know, people believe there will be less bombing. Although, of course, that's very tricky, you know, because sometimes you go to a village and exactly there is where the aircraft attack you. And then many people are moving inside Belgrade. You know, for example, people who live near a bridge, right, would leave because they think the bridge may be hit.
How come everyone isn't in a bomb shelter?
Well, you see, this is a very good question. We have bomb shelters here, and some are quite good in the sense that they are solid and so on. Also, of course, even if you don't have a properly made bomb shelter, you can go to your cellar, right, which could serve as a bomb shelter. And many people do go, but a large majority doesn't. And the reason is very simple, you see, because air attacks last, for example, in Belgrade, my estimate is on average 12 hours, right? And then, of course, to spend 12 hours in this cramped space where the air is damp, you know, it's also cold, and especially with small children who kind of cry and sometimes even get ill, right? And also, it's a kind of very great pressure on your psyche because there are always some people who are panicking. You know, people tell all sorts of exaggerated stories and so on. So that's one reason why people don't go to bomb shelters. And, of course, NATO announced that they are going to keep all of Serbia under air attacks 24 hours a day, right? And that, of course, there is no military rationale for that, right? I mean, an air attack on Belgrade, there is no military reason why it has to last 12 hours, right? But I think they're doing this partly to break the will of the people and to wear them out and so on, you know. I mean, NATO, of course, the easiest way to wear people out would be to start shooting at civilians. But, of course, the public opinion in the West, in particular in America, right, would not accept that, you know, killing hundreds of civilians intentionally. So they're then trying to think of kind of other ways, you know, within, to coin a phrase, the limits of military correctness, you know, where they could kind of intimidate the population without going for an all-out slaughter, which, needless to say, you know, American public or West European public would not accept. This is my explanation, my guess. Of course, it could be something else there.
What makes you think that, you said, if I heard you correctly, that you think NATO, if it could, would actually be targeting civilians? Is that what you said?
Fair enough. I mean, when I say NATO, I stay corrected, right? I don't mean, for example, I think that majority of NATO when we speak of NATO as kind of countries in NATO, would disapprove of that. My guess would be, you know, there's some commanding officers, you know, but this is, I'm just saying, this is my impression, my estimate. I could easily be wrong. Would favor that, you know. For example, let us say the American four-star general Wesley Clark, who is the commander of NATO in Europe and who is in charge of these operations, my judgment of his personality is that he's someone so obsessed with power, with victory, right? There is a sadistic streak when you listen to him, the way he speaks, the way he formulates sentences, you know. I mean, really enjoying the power that he has, the fear he inspires. For example, that kind of man, I could imagine, would attack civilian buildings. But as I said, you know, I could be unfair to Kim. This is just my impression. And you have to say, you know, I have also to add that when you are in a city which is being bombed, you know, you tend to judge harshly those who bomb you. So with these reservations, accept what I just said.
How do you think the NATO bombing is affecting popular opinion about Milosevic in Serbia?
You know, the many people in America expected that once first cruise missiles hit their targets, you know, people will turn against Milosevic. I was always telling people, you know, this is, you know, sort of billion-dollar miscalculation and misjudgment. And of course, you know, the moment bombs started hitting, right, opposition simply disappeared, right? I mean, we are not divided anymore in Serbia into those who are for Milosevic or against Milosevic. We are all united against NATO bombing. And this is not so peculiar. For example, Americans unite around the president in time of war. And of course, America fights wars far away from its own territory. And imagine if America was attacked, right? I mean, you know, all sins and follies of President Clinton would be immediately forgotten, right? That does not mean, of course, this is something that people don't understand. It does not mean Milosevic has become extremely popular, right? I mean, those who are against him, including myself, are still against him, right? And I don't think that if there were elections, you know, that now or in few weeks, that he would win an overwhelming victory. Far from it. Nevertheless, we have put internal politics on hold. You know, political parties don't exhibit party symbols. There is very little kind of political debate, and we are all concentrated on one hand of just stopping the bombing and somehow surviving, and on the other hand on somehow resolving the Kosovo crisis. So in that sense, it was a victory of Milosevic. But you don't see much of him, you know. For example, there are public meetings everywhere in Serbia. Every day there is one in Belgrade, you know, accompanied with rock music and so on, just to boost people's morale. And you rarely see Milosevic's pictures, right? You sometimes see them in smaller towns in Serbia where he has more support, you know, but very little. And for example, if a speaker mentions his name, there is a rather anemic applause, you know. So he has not become, some people say, he's becoming Churchill of Serbia. This is not true. But it is even less true to believe and to hope that he will be overthrown and that people will turn against him.
My guest is Aleksa Gilas, a Serb writer and political analyst who's joining us by phone from his home in Belgrade. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our phone call to Aleksa Gilas in Belgrade. He's a Serb writer and political analyst and a former research associate at Harvard's Russian Research Center. You had said that if there were an election tomorrow that Milosevic probably would win it, but not by a huge margin. But it strikes me that we're not talking about just politics as usual. President Milosevic is responsible for ethnic cleansing in Kosovo now. And, you know, I imagine you're aware of the hundreds of thousands of refugees who have been forced out of Kosovo. And I'm wondering how that's affected your opinion and the opinion of people who you're close to about Milosevic.
People in Serbia are not aware. I mean, they kind of know that something, that there is lots of fighting in Kosovo and that people are leaving. But they're not aware how many refugees have left Kosovo. Right. So this is one reason. Then, of course, you know, I have to tell you the story about Kosovo, right? Milosevic has ruled Serbia for 12 years, as I said before. And he has not practiced ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. You can accuse Milosevic of many things when Albanians in Kosovo are concerned. You can accuse him, and I did accuse him in numerous articles and interviews, that, for example, why did he take away the autonomy, or most of it, to Kosovo Albanians? The police force in Kosovo was mixed Albanian-Serbian. Under Milosevic, it became almost completely Serbian. Many Albanians were dismissed from work, right? There were cases of police brutality, you know, people arrested without good reason and so on. But these were more kind of human rights, minority rights violations. There was no large-scale cleansing, and the number of people killed in Kosovo for many years was very, very small, right? Then the situation became worse with the appearance of Kosovo Liberation Army in 1996. There you have the beginnings of a low-level civil war, but still we are talking about, you know, maybe 15, 20 people killed every year, both policemen and fighters of the Kosovo Liberation Army and innocent civilians and so on. This I'm mostly quoting Amnesty International reports, right? It's not some Serbian sources. But then it was only the bombing, which started 3 years ago, which transformed this low-level civil war into a real civil war. So what I think is going on in Kosovo, right, and this is based on just my general knowledge of nationalist conflicts both in the Balkans and elsewhere. I don't have any direct information from Kosovo, but I also watch, for example, CNN and Sky News and German television programs. What I think has happened is that, first of all, because of the bombing, many people have left just to run away from bombing. And I'm certain that this is the main cause, because so many people in Belgrade, as I told you at the very beginning, right, have left their home because they are afraid of bombing. And Kosovo is bombed much more intensely, with much greater ferocity than Belgrade.
I want to stop you for a second. Yep. Now, you said that you were certain that it's the NATO bombing that's driving the refugees out of Kosovo.
No. But, I think this is the main cause, but I'm also...
Well, the main cause, but according to the reports coming out of... across the border from Kosovo, in Macedonia, for instance, and where the other refugees are going, reporters are saying that the stories they're getting from refugees aren't about fleeing the bombs. It's about fleeing or being forced out by Serbs who knock at the door and at gunpoint force you to leave right then and there. People don't have time to gather their belongings. They don't even have time to get all their clothes on. And they're just being forced out. And that's story after story after story supports that. Do you think that those reports have any credibility at all?
Absolutely. As I tried to explain to you in my previous answer, I'm not saying that there is no ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. I'm saying that there is no planned and systematic ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and that the major reason why people are leaving is the bombing, right? But as I said, there is a civil war being fought in Kosovo. In this civil war, you have on one side Kosovo Liberation Army and part of Albanian population which supports it. On the other side, you have Serbs, Serbian minority in Kosovo, their local militias and paramilitary force. I believe that both these groups, I have no direct evidence, but just by, you know, studying nationalism in Yugoslavia, in the Balkans, and in general, I'm sure that these groups commit crimes against civilians and that they expel civilians. And I would expect that in that sense, you know, Serbian local militias and paramilitaries have probably expelled Albanians, yes. But what I'm trying to say is that this is not something Milosevic of Serbia have planned before, because, you know, they had 12 years of his rule to do that, and they haven't done it. Why would they be waiting for NATO bombing, where, from the point of view of Serbia's international reputation, it is the most damaging thing they could possibly do to do something, which in any case cannot give any lasting results. Because even if you expelled several hundred thousand Albanians from Kosovo, they would still remain an overwhelming majority in Kosovo. And in any case, you know, these people who are expelled, most of them will return, right? Everyone knows that the moment a peace treaty is signed. In any case, the official policy of the Yugoslav government, the proclaimed goal is the return of refugees. They are calling refugees back all the time. The column of refugees, which was, I hope, accidentally attacked by a NATO bomber yesterday, they were actually returning from Albania into Kosovo. So I'm not in any way saying that there is no ethnic cleansing or that no Serbian forces have committed crimes against humanity. I'm saying that this is not planned, systematic operation. And that the lion's share of responsibility for whatever is happening in Kosovo now lies with NATO. Because before NATO attacks, you had a kind of low-level civil war. In Kosovo, you had human rights violations of minority rights. You had some massacres, both committed by KLA and Serbian forces. But no one, no international observer, verifying mission, no Western journalist, spoke of ethnic cleansing, right? So to the extent that there is ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, it is either directly or indirectly caused by NATO bombing. By this, I don't mean that there are no Serbs in Kosovo who should not be brought to trial. Of course there are.
Let me ask you, I know that you don't think that Milosevic is responsible for ethnic cleansing and that you doubt that is going on in anything like the scale that's been reported. But say hypothetically it was.
Yes.
Say hypothetically that you believed it was, is what I mean.
Okay.
Do you think that the bombing of Serbia would be an appropriate response to that? Do you think that the bombing of Serbia would be an appropriate way to try to get President Milosevic to stop the ethnic cleansing? Or do you think that risking the lives of civilians, even though they're not directly being targeted, is an inappropriate way?
Well, I mean, if I really knew, you know, that people... If you ask me personally, if I really knew that people, that ordinary Albanians in Kosovo are somehow helped by the hardship we are enduring, right, I would probably say, okay, guys, carry on, right? Of course, most Serbs would not agree with me, right? Because, you know, everyone is primarily interested in his own security. And I have to tell you, Americans are not any different. For example, most Americans are much more concerned that three American soldiers are in Serbian captivity than by the fact that, for example, NATO plane struck a factory which was not military, or that it hit the day before yesterday a train where some dozen civilians were killed, you know. So every nation is primarily, you know, concerned about its own suffering. So most people here would tell you no. I personally would tell you yes, you know. Even if it was absolutely right that there was systematic ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and even if the only way to stop it would be to bomb Serbia, I would expect that overwhelming majority of Serbs would be against it. I personally, as I said, I would be for it, but that's just a mini minority.
I want to ask you a few more things about what life is like in Belgrade now. How much of what you do on a daily basis has been directly affected by the bombing? And I'm thinking specifically, are there places that supply your food or places that you would go on a daily basis that don't exist anymore?
Well, as far, you know, shops are still full, but many people say that most of industry does not work. And, of course, there are very little imports. And we suspect that soon, government will not be able, people will not get their monthly wages. So the government will have to issue coupons. You see what I mean? Like for milk and cooking oil and whatever, potatoes and so on. So many people, including myself, you know, we have bought some food, you know, so that it can last us maybe a month, you know. I probably would not have done this if I lived on my own, you know, but when you have two children, you tend to think along those lines, you know. And then, of course, there are no cigarettes, or there is a shortage of cigarettes, rather. And so things like that. But, for example, traffic still functions, and you can even hire a taxi in Belgrade. You know, so that means there is still enough gasoline.
I was glad that you were able to talk with us today, because it was my understanding that it was against the law now in Serbia to give interviews to the foreign press. Is that against the law now?
I am not aware of such a law, but I can tell you, for example, that, let us say, no one has tried to censor me for many years, in which I have criticized government, Milosevic, Serbian nationalism, and so on, you know. If anyone had tried to censor me, for example, I don't know, several months ago, for example, I would have said no, I will not be censored, and I would have been ready to go to jail. I'm saying this without any pathos. I mean, that's something I have thought about a lot, and that was my decision. For example, but let us see if after our conversation now, for example, tomorrow, you know, state security knocks on my door and tells me, you know, we think, you know, your interviews are bad for the security of our country, I would try to convince them that they are not, right? But if they insisted, I would probably stop giving interviews, not because I'm afraid of them, but because I would be thinking that under the circumstances and in the situation where we are in war, it is not patriotic to challenge the authorities. But I'm not sure. I haven't made up my mind, you know. But this is probably the 30th interview I have given since the war started, and no one ever has threatened me in any way. So I hope it doesn't happen.
Alexa Gilas spoke to us from his home in Belgrade. We recorded our interview earlier today. Gilas is the author of the book The Contested Country, Yugoslav Unity and Communist Revolution, and he's a former research associate at Harvard's Russian Research Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Antioch University, a place for writers, on the web at www.antioch.edu or 937-767-6494. And Bantam Books, publisher of Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest by Wayne Muller. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, reuniting refugees from Kosovo who have been separated from their families. We'll talk with Martin Merkelbach in Macedonia. He runs the Red Cross program that traces lost family members and tries to reunite them. And we'll talk with Randy Ackley of the Red Cross, who's working at the Brashta refugee camp in Macedonia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many refugees got separated from their families in the process of fleeing Kosovo and settling in refugee camps. The International Committee of the Red Cross is trying to help some of those people find their families through a tracing system. My guest, Martin Merkelbach, is the head of tracing services for the ICRC in Macedonia. We called him in Macedonia earlier today, and he described how the system works.
You have to imagine that people under stress, panic, fear have been moving. And it's a little bit like at the end of a ball game or on a very, very busy Saturday afternoon at a supermarket. You lose people in that sort of context. A mass of people is moving. So different parts of your family end up in different places. Now, there isn't a meeting point many of these places, because here we have six camps where people could be. They could be out of the camp in the country somewhere. They could even have ended up in a neighboring country like Albania. They could still be Montenegro. So the potential places of where your wife or your child has ended up multiplies. What we do is that we register cases here that we find. We take the name of their parent or the family member that they're looking for, and try to find out if these people do the same thing in the other context, Albania, Montenegro, or in European countries where people arrive, have done the same thing, and then we can match them up.
How many people have registered so far?
Well, we can't register the hundreds of thousands of people this concerns. So what we concentrate on is on the most vulnerable cases at this stage. I mean, young children, very elderly people, handicapped people. Those we will look for actively and we register on a database. For example, here in Skopje, we have almost 200 children who lost their parents. They're without any adult family member. What we provide for the adults is that they have the chance to write a message, a Red Cross message, and if they have a vague idea of where their relatives could be, we can see if we can deliver that message. For example, many people have heard via people that have moved around that they've seen their husband in another camp or in another country. We can take the message, we'll take it to this other camp, and see if we can identify this person. We'll set up a little tent in the other camp, and people who are interested in finding out if there's a message for them can come by and pick up this message.
So you find out that the family that you've been separated from is in a camp in another country. Can the Red Cross help you get to the rest of your family if the trip is a big one?
No, that's the next step. Once you've figured out where parts of your family are, they want to be reunified. Again, we can't help hundreds of thousands of people. I think we helped a lot already once we've put them back in touch again. We can help more actively the more vulnerable people. It's across countries, needless to say, embassies and national directives have to be observed. So the final decision is really with a host country government of where these people have arrived or want to go to. But we can facilitate for the most vulnerable cases the application for visas and present cases that are more vulnerable that cannot do it themselves. So yes, we do quite a lot of that already.
Have you come across children who are too young to talk and to give you information, or even infants who are totally unable to supply you any information that would explain who they were or who their families are?
We have a few cases that you find with mentally handicapped people or very young children. But the majority of children know who they are, who their parents are, and what their address was back home. Imagine that if four children travel with their mother in a refugee flow, the mother will probably carry the youngest child. So it's the elder ones who walk around and who most likely get split off. So most of the children that we have are between 10 and 15. There are some babies. They're mostly babies that were taken in the middle of the emergency by medical services, taken to hospital. So if the mother tells us, they took my baby on them that day, I don't know which hospital he is, I'm very worried, we take a team, we go around all the hospitals in town, and we'll identify with the doctors in the hospital which babies were brought in on them that time. And we do find that we already have reunified babies with their mothers again.
What kind of emotional and physical shape are most of the children who've been separated from their families in?
The older they get, the more affected they are by what they've been through. The strange thing is, of course, that children adapt very quickly. They don't perhaps realize very well what is happening around them. So the children, they probably take a longer time to digest it over time, but at the moment they're doing quite all right. I think the people who are most worried are the parents. They know what's happened. They know the risk they're running, and they're the ones that lie awake at night wondering about, whether they'll ever see their child again.
So is this system that you have now computerized?
We have a very small little database here where we have 185 children registered with their location, and we're looking for their parents. We made a small list of about 400 parents that we localized. We're looking for children. We do that locally. We try to do as much here between the camps and town because most likely these people are somewhere near us. Now, if that will succeed over the next 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks, month, all those who haven't been able to reunify will have to centralize it in a database that connects with the same work done in Albania and in the host country where refugees have arrived, and then see if we can find the parents in these other places. We haven't centralized all of the people yet in one database, but we'll have to consider at what stage we do that.
Let me ask you a question that might sound very odd and incredibly cynical, but is there ever the fear that somebody would use your system to track down an enemy as opposed to track down a family?
Key is that we only exchange family news between family members.
Mm-hmm.
So we will only ask, will only allow a person to write a message to a family member. And on the other side, the person that says, is there a message for me, will verify whether he hears a family member. Ask him some questions. Do you know this person? What is it? And you can tell emotionally whether people are emotionally involved or not. So these are not public messages, and they're not for non-related persons. So that eliminates a lot of the potential of abuse.
My guest is Martin Merkelbach, head of tracing services in Macedonia for the International Committee of the Red Cross. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Merkelbach. He runs the Red Cross program in Macedonia that is helping lost refugees reunite with the families they were separated from while fleeing Kosovo or entering refugee camps. Are there still a lot of cases from, we'll say even Bosnia and earlier wars that are still open where the families have not been relocated?
Well, unfortunately, in this sort of situation, yeah, in spite of the fact that you can help a lot of people find out about each other, every context has its open cases that will never be resolved. For example, the Central Tracing Agency in Geneva still occasionally treats cases that date back to World War I. Very regularly, weekly, we get cases for World War II. Other big operations in which we were involved, like the Cambodian crisis, the earlier Yugoslavian war, many, many cases are still being treated locally. So we can expect that for what happens here at this time, that we'll have work for many, many years to come.
Where else have you worked on tracing systems?
Rwanda, for example. When 2 million Rwandans fled abroad and settled up these refugee camps, this was 94, when 1999 meant now, 5 years, it's still going on for thousands of cases.
How does the system you've created in each place compare?
Well, the newness of this situation here is that in Macedonia, a lot of people arrived with portable phones. They used them for a few days so they could call other people. And they've called relatives in Europe who call other people. There's a huge network among these people across the world. Now, batteries are flat, but they still have their little telephone address book, so they're borrowing and using portable phones or sat phones that are available in the camps among humanitarian organizations for the press. So there's a lot of phone calling happening, which means that they can find out quite a lot themselves. For example, yesterday I walked in the camp, a woman approaches you with an address book. All she wants is to quickly call to Germany to tell her husband that where she is and that she's all right. So this satisfies already the first and primary need to want to take away the pain from somebody who doesn't know what's happened. The next problem is to be able to write to them and get the procedures going that they can be reunified. That's very particular for this context. In Rwanda, you didn't have that, of course, because people did not have phones. They just simply moved. And they relied on a Red Cross message system, which took a bit longer.
Is the Red Cross trying to set up battery rechargers for cell phones?
There's, in some camps, these are available. What we provide between the camps is the Red Cross message system, because we can do it quickly. The camps are very close to each other, sometimes only 10 minutes drive, sometimes only 20 minutes drive, so we can bring these things up and down very rapidly. There are points being set up in camps where people can call.
Can I ask what inspired you to do this kind of work?
I think what inspired me is, as a young boy, listening to my father's experiences during the Second World War and wondering how I would have reacted myself if I'd been in a situation like that. Now, fortunately, I live in a country and in an age where, yeah, war hasn't happened to me, but I wanted to see what I could do in situations like that and how I would react and how it would help. So I joined the International Committee of the Red Cross, and I found out that it is extremely satisfying to work like that, and that I feel useful. And at least I don't do any damage. Maybe if I can't help, I don't do any damage, and very often I can help. I think what we do makes an enormous amount of difference to many people, even if it's only a small part of the many, many people who need more assistance.
What was your father's situation during the war?
My father was a young man who joined the police, and then Germany invaded the Netherlands. And he had to work as a police officer under German occupation, which caused, of course, many, many troubles because the Dutch population wasn't in agreement with the German policies. How do you deal with it? So there were many, many experiences that he tried to deal with and perform his function and serve the population, at the same time trying to avoid following orders that he didn't agree with. Eventually, he had to go underground and try to work in the resistance and help people anyway. So he had to risk his life to do that. And then after the war, deal with these experiences and trying to set up a normal life with all the consequences of the trauma of the war.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work and about trying to reunite refugees from Kosovo. Thank you very much and good luck.
Happy to talk to you. Thank you.
Martin Merkelbach is the head of tracing services in Macedonia for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Randy Ackley is working at refugee camps in Macedonia. He's a public information delegate with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He's working with the hospital, the water treatment program, and the tracing services program that is trying to reunite refugee families that have been separated while fleeing Kosovo. We spoke with him this morning from Macedonia. Earlier in the day, he was at the Brashta refugee camp when a truck of refugees pulled in. I asked if those refugees had been brought there to be reunited with lost family members.
Yes. What we were able to do was identify families that had been split between two different refugee camps. It was pretty heartwarming to see. I was in the Brashta camp where the refugees were brought in an army truck, about 25 people in the back of a truck with a canvas over it and an open back. And as they came out, you could tell that many of them were tired, but they had been staying in the Boyane camp about 40 kilometers away. You could also tell that the crowds outside the area that was cordoned off were very excited about seeing family members and friends that were getting off of the truck. It was very exciting for them. So even though they were tired, and you could tell they were ready to find somewhere to settle down, they were pretty heartened at the moment.
Have you heard any specific stories about how the families were separated from each other?
I have, actually. And unfortunately, in the rush to bring people to more safe conditions from the Blache retention area by Blache, unfortunately, people got split up in the rush. One young lady with her 18-month-old baby girl was in my car the other night, and she had explained that their family was pretty much together up until Blache, and then they were separated. Her husband and she and her two daughters were separated from their other daughter and son. The daughter was 16 and the son 10. She described not being able to eat, and neither was her husband, for over a week because they had no idea where their children were. And then the night that we were able to reunify them, she said, "You know, I feel like I'm in Paris. I feel like I could jump to the moon." This same lady in that same conversation explained that, you know, a year ago we had our business, we had our home, we were happily settled, a family, you know, having our lives, and now all we have left are this, our souls and the clothes on our backs. And so there's a real mix of emotions there. First, of course, the trauma of what everybody, all of the refugees are going through, and certainly the trauma that this family had gone through. But then, of course, they were just absolutely thrilled that the Red Cross was able to locate their children and get them back to each other's arms.
How did the system work for them in reuniting them?
What's happening at this point is the Red Cross system, we register refugees at the camps. We register them in the communities where they've taken refuge with host families. And we also have registration with the countries that are accepting refugees, the third-party countries that are accepting refugees. All of that data is going into a computer system run by the International Committee of the Red Cross. The system also is being provided information from Albania as it becomes available, and as soon as we're able to get into Yugoslavia, we'll be providing information from the Kosovo area and Yugoslavia as a whole. What we're hearing now, what we're seeing now, are those people who have been split apart between camps, and that's fairly easy to connect because the data is readily available. People are getting the data in as we speak, and we can make the connection because they're close in proximity. But unfortunately, the fact is it will probably take longer for people, for a lot of people, to find each other. One of the very sad elements of this whole tragic disaster is that we've already, as of yesterday, received over 250, between 250 and 270 children who have come to the Red Cross, 18 years and younger, and said, can you please help me find my family? And we've received 735 parents have come to the Red Cross and said, please help me find my children. Of those, only three matched. So just as of yesterday, we know that there are over 1,000 children split from their families, and the unfortunate truth is we know that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are hundreds of thousands of people who have been displaced, and any normal mass movement of people, there is a small percentage, 2 to 5% of children that gets separated from their parents, and here we're seeing a tremendous number of people who have gone through that, and we're very concerned about the number of people who have been separated from their children. So that's our highest priority at this point.
In your discussions with refugees, I'm sure the subject must come up of why they fled Kosovo in the first place. What patterns are you hearing?
Well, I think we've all been hearing very similar stories. And they aren't... it's easy to understand why people have come here. The stories I'm hearing are of people who have been forcibly asked or forced from their homes and from their towns. And
are you hearing anything?
That, I really can't say.
You know, some of the Serbs are saying it's not that they were forced out of their homes; it's that they're fleeing the NATO bombing. Have you heard directly from any refugees that they left Kosovo because of the NATO bombing?
No, I've been here about 5 days. I've never heard that.
My guest is Randy Ackley. He's working with the Red Cross in refugee camps in Macedonia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randy Ackley, a public information delegate with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He's speaking to us from Macedonia. He was working in the Brazda refugee camp today. What are conditions like now at the refugee camp where you are? And maybe you could kind of describe the camp for us.
The camp is actually very well organized, but it's a camp. I mean, it's many, many tents. There are several camps I've been to. Brajda is the one today with, there are roughly 2,000 tents in the camp. And the population I've heard, it's not reliable, but because the numbers have changed since I last heard this number, but it was at one point holding 26,000 people. It might be more or less now. The services provided are pretty thorough. We're very comfortable at the moment that we have the vital necessities, the life-sustaining necessities, the food and the water that are necessary. The camp management has done a good job of getting those supplies to the refugees. The Red Cross and other organizations are working together to supply them. But, you know, with all of that said, it's organized, it's orderly. People have a place to feel somewhat secure. They're living in tents out in the open on what used to be a sports airfield, which gets freezing cold at night, which can be blistering hot in the sun. And the things that they need most at times are things like telephones. And we have an organization, the ICMC, which has actually set up telephones, which is helping tremendously. But this is not the life you or I would choose. It's not a life anybody would want. And it's it can be a terrible existence, even though your vital necessities are met. So it can be very hard.
You've been working with the Red Cross Field Hospital. What kind of health problems are you seeing?
What the hospital is seeing is, of course, pregnancies. There are several people who are pregnant and are receiving care from the field hospital. But we're also seeing, in children especially, bronchial problems, pneumonia. We have patients with pneumonia. We have cases of digestive problems, some diarrhea, even in some cases constipation, which is a serious issue if you're feeling uncomfortable and you have pain. So a variety of things, but the good news is we don't have any evidence of any epidemics at this point. The population that's come into the camp is relatively healthy and well-nourished, for the most part, people are in fairly good health. So that's the very good news, but of course, given this high population kept in a very small area, everybody needs to maintain their vigilance and maintain the sanitary control and keep on top of the medical issues as they arise.
We're hearing reports that there are still more refugees headed out of Kosovo. You were at the border today. Which part of the border were you at and what did you see?
I was at a crossing at Blace, and what I saw were several hundred refugees who were coming over from Kosovo. This time, they had come over on foot from close to the border. They had actually driven from their villages just this morning, and they were forced to leave their cars and transportation away from the crossing point. But they were being bused to the Brajda refugee camp about 10 kilometers away. The people were in pretty good condition. There were a few that were exhausted. One man was on a stretcher for exhaustion and kidney problems. But the interesting thing was that we were told that there were additional 30 to 40 tractors coming that hadn't yet arrived, each tractor carrying a load of refugees. So we haven't seen them yet. We're waiting to see them to get an idea of what that will involve.
You know, Randy, I know it's your job as a public information delegate with the Red Cross to deal with the media, people such as those of us here at Fresh Air. The refugee camps have become really a big media event. Like, you can put on certain cable news stations in the United States, and you're likely to see a broadcast from a refugee camp. And I'm just wondering what it's been like for you on the media end. Because it really has become not only a tragic event, but also a media event.
Well, I think there are a couple of points. One is there is the feeling of working with our friends amongst the refugees. They want their story told. They clearly know that the world is interested, and they don't want. They don't seem to shy away from some attention, although then there's the other point where at times the media attention can be obtrusive. There's no way around it. And What I think many people are concerned about is that, you know, if a family is just reunited, it's a wonderful story, and up till now they've been very understanding and working with us and with the media, and it's been terrific. But I think at one point I was a little concerned when I saw a camera crew actually get into a tent with a family. I thought that was a little bit obtrusive. On the other hand, the family was fine, and they were fine with it. But we do try to make sure that whenever the media is involved, certainly if we're present from the Red Cross, we make sure that the families are open to and willing to participate and are willing to have the media watch them as they go through what are incredibly personal experiences. Another aspect is the camp is a very large place. So when a crew sets up a place to do live shots or they set up a semi-permanent place to do broadcasts from, it really isn't that doesn't seem to be that much of a problem, and actually the kids like watching and getting involved, so it can be fun from that perspective.
Randy, what inspired you to do this kind of work, to work with the Red Cross?
I was a lawyer in Miami and started volunteering with the Red Cross, and I just have to tell you that as a volunteer and working with a disaster, in that case, my first disaster was a hotel fire, sitting with a family and helping provide the father with dentures so that he could chew food again. You can't do that. You can't do things like that, helping people like that, and not want to do more of it. And frankly, volunteering with the Red Cross and working with Red Cross has been the most rewarding thing I can possibly imagine. So I guess that's it.
Randy Ackley is a public information delegate with the International Committee for the Red Cross. He spoke to us from Macedonia. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Kathy Wolf. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Tor Books, publisher of Terry Goodkind's Soul of the Fire, available wherever books are sold. Warner Books, publisher of Business at the Speed of Thought by Bill Gates, available in hardcover and as a Time Warner audiobook, on the web at speedofthought.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 1999 Pulitzer Prizes were announced earlier this week. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with some of the winners. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.